Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Monday, April 29th, 2024. I'm your reader, Mary Frances, and you are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of folks with print disabilities. Taking a look at the front page of the Sioux City Journal today, the big story headline is Deadly Pattern, Lee Enterprises Special Report. Police kill Native Americans at a rate 5 times that of whites and 3 times of blacks. Another story is auditor must give evidence to withhold emails. And we'll start with the Lee Enterprises special report, Deadly Pattern. This is Dateline, Parmalee, South Dakota. Weldon Poorbear received a powerful gift on Father's Day 35 years ago. The birth of identical twin sons. He fondly recalls raising them in the traditions of their native Lakota heritage, with sweat lodges, ceremonial pipes, and sun dances. There were baseball games and cross-country meets, and his son Adam's ambition to become a police officer. But the memories of all that remain of Poor Bear's biological children. Near midnight on March 14, 2018, Poor Bear stood outside his house on the Rosebud Indian Reservation and watched and then listened as Adam was shot and killed by a tribal police officer. Adam was unarmed, according to official records in the case. It was a profoundly personal loss for Poor Bear, who had already lost Adam's twin Arthur to suicide a decade before. But Adam's killing is also part of an alarming and rarely discussed trend that has made Native Americans more likely than any other racial group to die in encounters with law enforcement. Despite witnessing some parts of Adam's fatal encounter, including seeing him run from police and hearing the gunshot that ended his life, Poor Bear remains largely in the dark about why and how his son was killed that night. While accurate counts and solid information are difficult to come by, one thing is clear. Poor Bear is far from alone in mourning a Native American loved one killed by police and searching in vain for answers. A Lee Enterprises public service journalism team investigation examined deaths of Native Americans in encounters with law enforcement over the past 10 years, with a focus on the on- and off-reservation communities of South Dakota, where such fatal encounters are particularly common. Interviews with dozens of surviving family members, law enforcement officers, attorneys, and others, as well as reporting trips to Native American communities, both on and off tribal land, and the examination of lawsuits, police records, and other documents and data, give new insight about the forces that have been fueling these deaths. This investigation found, bullet point, across the United States, Native Americans died at a significantly higher rate than any other racial or ethnic group in police encounters between 2017 and 2020. Bullet, a lack of funding for police in tribal communities contributed to fatal law enforcement incidents both on and off tribal lands. Next bullet, loved ones of those who died in police pursuits, police shootings, and jails struggle to access even the most basic information about how those deaths occur. Bullet, a lack of accountability and oversight in the case of such deaths exacerbates distrust between Native Americans and law enforcement. And the final bullet, such deaths often go unreported by the media. According to its most recent data, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention found that Native Americans died as a result of law enforcement interventions at a rate of 1.6 per 100,000 in 2020. That's more than 5 times the rate for whites, who died at a rate of 0.3, and nearly triple the rate for blacks, who died at a rate of 0.6. Tonya Black Elk, one of the lead organizers of Native Lives Matter, said such fatal police shootings are so prevalent now in the relatively small indigenous community that, quote, we're all related to somebody or somebody has multiple people in their family who have died this way. The cops are doing this so much in such a fast-paced way that we're all becoming related through this, Black Elk said. Law enforcement officials, interviewed as part of this series, argued that officers work hard to avoid deadly outcomes. In an email response to questions, Robin Broyles, a Bureau of Indian Affairs spokesperson, wrote that police on tribal land work to, quote, keep Native people safe in their homes and communities. BIA and tribal law enforcement officers are not just employees working on reservations. They are most often tribal members themselves, with personal connections and a desire to make Indian country a safer, healthier, more prosperous place, Broyles wrote. Then they continued, as such, these officers know the history of their neighbors and are intimately connected to the communities and law enforcement entities that surround reservations. This community relationship is a defining characteristic of what makes working in OJS unique and relevant to tribal communities. While the deaths of Black Americans at the hands of police have drawn significant media attention and public scrutiny, the fact that Natives are even more likely to die in such encounters has been largely overlooked, even by reformers, Black Elk said. We get left out of all talks of police reforms, Black Elk said. We get left out of all talks of community control of the police. We get excluded from everything. A 2018 report from the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights suggested a lack of attention may be connected to a lack of reporting. Quote, the best available data suggests that Native Americans are being killed in police encounters at a higher rate than other racial groups, but these killings may be undercounted by federal agencies and are underreported by the media, the report said. The report also found that undercounting is compounded as tribes often lack media presence on their reservations and lack monetary resources to create and disseminate those public records, unquote. The CDC used death certificates, coroner and medical examiner records, and law enforcement reports to produce its data. Public databases that seek to compile such fatal encounters, on the other hand, rely on news reports to produce databases that track law enforcement killings by race, gender, and other factors. A Lee Enterprises analysis of three of those online databases, Fatal Encounters, Mapping Police Violence, and the Washington Post's Fatal Force Tracker, identified 29 Native Americans killed in such encounters in 2020, while the CDC counted 40 deaths that year. The disparity between their counts appears to confirm the notion that some Native deaths in law enforcement encounters go unreported in the media. Sunny Redbear, an action organizer with the NDN Collective, which is an activist group based in Rapid City, South Dakota, said the publicly available data is not merely inaccurate, but also misconstrued. What's happening is that the truth isn't being told, that it's not being talked about, said Red Bear. It's being sugarcoated and covered up and swept under the rug. With 324 federally recognized reservations, 574 tribes, and 87% of the 3.7 million people who identify only as American, Indian, or Alaskan Native living off tribal land, it's difficult to generalize about the causes of each of the hundreds of Indigenous people killed by police over the past two decades. Local and individual circumstances vary widely. In an effort to hone in on the causes and effects of high rates of fatal encounters between Native Americans and law enforcement, Lee's investigation centered on South Dakota, where Native Americans represent about 8.5% of the state's population, but they were victims of 75% of the fatal police shootings since 2000, according to data compiled by the NDN Collective. Future stories in this series will focus on fatal police encounters between Native Americans and local police in Rapid City, tribal police on the Rosebud Indian Reservation, and Bureau of Indian Affairs police on the Standing Rock Indian Reservation. South Dakota is one state in a region of the Northern Plains where a recent study by the economist Matthew Harvey suggests that Native people die in police encounters at an alarmingly high rate relative to whites when adjusting the data to account for population disparities. Harvey's paper focused in part on the 9th Federal Reserve District, which extends from Montana to the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. There, Harvey found that Native American men had 14 times as many fatal encounters with police as white men over the period from 2000 to 2017. Using the same criteria, Native American women had 38 times as many fatal encounters with police when compared to white women. The numbers are so high that Harvey initially had a hard time believing them. Quote, "I honestly ran the numbers at first and I'm like, this can't be right. This has to be wrong. My code is not good," Harvey said. "But then I went back and ran it again, and I'm like, nope, the code is right. This is striking," unquote. Municipal and state police departments have jurisdiction outside of reservations, but the federal government plays a major role in tribal land, where the BIA's Office of Justice Services largely funds law enforcement. In some cases, personnel from OJS police tribal citizens directly at a tribe's request. But in most cases, tribes contract with the BIA to operate their own police departments, and when someone is shot on tribal lands, the FBI is tasked with investigating. "That's a job the FBI treats with, quote, the utmost seriousness," said FBI Public Affairs Specialist Diana Freeman in an email response to questions. Agents, she said, spare no effort in establishing the facts. In annual reports produced for Congress, the BIA acknowledged that public safety and criminal justice programs in Indian country are woefully underfunded. The Bureau's most recent report, which covered 2021, found total law enforcement needs for tribes amounted to $1.7 billion, but that only $256.4 million was spent. Overall, Indian Country BIA Public Safety and Justice is funded at just under 13% of total need, the report said. It also said that just 3,781 people were employed in these positions as of 2021, and that, quote, an additional 25,655 personnel are required to adequately serve Indian Country, unquote. The result is police departments that are seriously understaffed, said Charles Addington, who served as the director of the BIA's Office of Justice Services from 2017 until 2020, and is now chief marshal for the Quapaw Nation's Law Enforcement Department. Broyles acknowledged that, quote, funding and resource limitations do impact law enforcement programs in Indian Country, as it affects a program's ability to hire and retain critical police and correctional programs personnel needed to safely police and staff correctional facilities. It also creates challenges with updating aging police and correctional facilities, unquote. She noted that the BIA is working on several strategies to support recruitment and retention. Crime has festered on tribal land, and federal data shows that violent crime rates have been found to be more than 2.5 times as high on reservations as off. Quote, "I think everything's related to crime rates," Addington said. "The more crime," he added, "the more you're increasing the probability that you're going to encounter someone that you may have to have deadly force or any kind of force with," unquote. When those encounters do happen, the fewer law enforcement officers you have working these reservations, the more dangerous it is for everybody, according to Walter Lamar, who is a citizen of the Blackfeet Nation and a former deputy director and acting director of law enforcement for the BIA. "Having too few officers puts the officers at much greater risk," Lamar said, "and it puts the citizens of the reservation at much greater risk, because when the police are outnumbered and overwhelmed, there's a much greater chance there's going to be some level of force used. Another factor that increases the odds of a deadly encounter," Addington said, "is the prevalence of substance abuse on reservations, and the fact that there are, quote, very, very, very few opportunities for treatment near reservations. If a suspect is under the influence of some type of narcotics and you encounter them," Addington said, "it increases the probability that you're going to have to take some type of force, or they're going to do something that they normally wouldn't do," he said. And when understaffed and underfunded tribal or BIA police have difficulty keeping up with the calls and emergencies confronting them, Addington said, they don't have time to properly train for such situations. About this series, Lee Enterprises' public service journalism team has spent more than a year digging into the causes and implications of Native Americans' disproportionately high rates of fatal encounters with law enforcement. Through public records requests, dozens of interviews, the examination of lawsuits, and multiple reporting trips to Native American communities, both on and off tribal land, reporter Ted McDermott has worked to understand the systemic forces that contribute to this trend and to hear many personal stories of how these deaths have reverberated within Indigenous communities. Future stories will examine fatal encounters that have occurred on and off tribal lands in South Dakota, where such deaths are particularly common. While avoiding all fatal encounters is not a realistic expectation in the law enforcement field, the BIA Indian Police Academy does an excellent job providing quality classroom and role-playing exercises that teach officers safe and effective arrest techniques, use of force, and non-lethal tactics, wrote Broyles of the BIA. The dynamics that fuel Native Americans' high rates of fatal encounters with police are not contained by the borders of reservations. Though it has not been intensely studied, evidence from Harvey's study suggests that Natives die even more often off tribal lands than on them, including in border towns and big cities, where Native Americans endure high crime rates and rely on predominantly non-Native police to provide safety. When Natives are killed in police encounters, bureaucratic hurdles mean the loved ones of those who die are often stymied in their efforts to pursue accountability or even receive basic information. On reservations, this is due in part to a jurisdictional thicket that makes it difficult to know how to request records or even who to request them from. In interviews for this story, the loved ones of those killed in law enforcement encounters all reported difficulty accessing information. While he's adamant that he's not a cop hater, Poor Bear believes the systemic problems like high crime rates, underfunding of law enforcement, poor training, low staffing levels, and lack of familiarity between officers and residents have not only fueled broader dysfunction on the Rosebud Reservation, but also directly contributed to his son's death. And law enforcement's lack of transparency, he said, has left him grieving and unable to move on. Asked about the FBI's process for keeping families informed after a fatal encounter, Friedman wrote that the Bureau, quote, typically designates one point of contact within a victim's family to provide updates on the case. She said the Bureau's Victim Specialist Program ensures consistent support and assistance to victims and their families. None of the families interviewed for this series, however, mentioned being contacted by or working with an FBI victim specialist, and nearly all said that they had never received documents such as autopsies and police reports, despite efforts to get documents that might address their questions or help them pursue accountability. Poor Bear has tried to take what action he could. He said he's called all kinds of numbers given to him by the FBI without ever getting assistance, answers or basic documents, such as an autopsy report. He even protested his lack of access to documentation before the Rosebud Sioux City Tribal Council, that's the tribe's sole legislative body, to try to, quote, get their attention. He put up a sign demanding justice for his son, alongside similar signs for other victims of police violence on the reservation. Poor Bear believes those documents might help him find clarity and perhaps a lawyer who could help him pursue justice. Sometimes I ask myself, if there's nothing to hide, give me the paperwork, he said. Recently, however, the federal government did share some of those documents in response to a Lee Enterprises public records request. But after identifying 797 pages of documents and 33 minutes of video that were potentially responsive to this request, The FBI estimated it would take 55 months to provide those materials. A Lee Enterprise reporter agreed to the agency's request to narrow the ask to 49 pages, a move expected to shorten processing time to 4 months. Instead, in March, after 8 months, the FBI provided 19 pages of documents with significant redactions, including blanking out the names of officers and witnesses. The U.S. Attorney's Office for South Dakota also provided a 7-page letter in response to the same records request. The FBI responded similarly to public records requests for documents related to 7 other fatal encounters with law enforcement on tribal lands in South Dakota. After Lee Enterprises filed those requests in the summer of 2023, the FBI's Information Management Division estimated that it would take between 4.5 to 6.5 years to provide all documents related to each investigation. The FBI then offered to provide up to 50 pages from each one in about 4 months. Though Lee agreed to this expedited approach, the shorter timelines were not met in all but one case. The Bureau released fewer than 25 pages in 3 cases, and no records related to 3 other investigations had been provided as of press time. The records related to the killing of Adam Poorbear offered his father a glimpse of what he has long sought, the official account of what happened near midnight, March 14, 2018. That account confirmed what Weldon Poorbear believed, that his son was unarmed when he was shot. But the documents obtained by Lee Enterprises also left many of Poorbear's questions unanswered and raised new ones. For example, the FBI's summary of an interview with the officer who killed Adam alleges that Adam not only threatened, but also, quote, assaulted his father. But in an interview with Lee Enterprises, Poorbear disputed that assertion. While he acknowledged his wife called 911 that night to report that Adam had hit the house with a hammer and was threatening to break car windows, Poorbear said his son didn't actually break any windows, never threatened him, and never assaulted him or anyone else. It was just a disturbance call, someone calling on him saying he was being obnoxious, Poorbear said of his son. But when the first tribal police officer arrived, Poorbear said, he got out of his vehicle all gung-ho and hyped up and started running right at Adam. That, Poorbear believes, unnecessarily escalated the situation from the start. The officer told FBI agents, however, that when he approached Adam and yelled his name, Adam responded by saying an expletive and then said, "You have to catch me first." A foot chase ensued as Adam led the officer through town and toward the powwow grounds on the edge of Parmalee. Poorbear and his wife watched it all happen from their front yard, pleading with their son to give himself up, but Adam wouldn't listen. A second officer approached the scene soon after, FBI files say, but he told interviewers that he was prevented from joining the pursuit because his vehicle got stuck in the mud. That left the first officer alone to search for Adam, eventually finding him face down on the ground in the grass of the powwow grounds. The officer ordered Adam to stay still, the U.S. Attorney's letter says, but Adam disobeyed and moved toward the officer and asked the officer to shoot him. When he was within about 10 feet of the officer, Adam pulled his hands from his pockets, and the officer attempted to fire his weapon, FBI documents say, but no bullet was discharged because the officer had forgot to load a round into the chamber. The officer then loaded a bullet, FBI files say, and the officer again yelled at Adam to stop moving and get down on the ground. But the FBI FOIA office entirely redacted the officer's description of why he pulled his trigger again, this time with his gun loaded. The U.S. Attorney's letter, however, fills in that blank with a description of what that office says happened. At one point, Adam was 5 to 8 yards from the officer, and Adam moved quickly and rushed toward the officer. He pulled his hands out of his pockets in an aggressive manner. At that time, the officer fired one shot and struck Adam in the upper chest. The officer who shot Adam told investigators he never saw the hammer or any other weapon. Neither did the officer whose vehicle got stuck. Boerbaer said he was watching the whole thing from only about 200 yards away, close enough that he said he could hear their voices and that he didn't hear anyone giving direct orders to get down or get back or something to his son. But there's no way to know what actually happened when the officer encountered Adam that night, as neither of the officers had their body cameras activated at the time of the shooting. The officer who fired the shot was wearing a camera that, quote, would not turn on, FBI documents state. And the officer who arrived next also had a body camera that was, quote, not operational when Adam was being pursued and then shot. And yet, the U.S. Attorney's letter states, one of the officers was able to activate his body camera immediately after the shooting. Boerbaer said he was surprised any footage was recorded, even if it only captured the aftermath of the officer firing. I wanted footage of the body cameras, he said, and they were like, we don't have any body cameras. These kinds of inconsistencies and gaps in the official account have left him baffled about why his unarmed son was shot dead, despite having no weapon and harming no one. That's what I told the FBI. Why'd you guys do that? He didn't hurt no one. He didn't even do nothing, Boerbaer recalled. I said this was a disturbance call. What's going on? What did he do? And while the documents obtained by Lee were the first Boerbaer has seen, he said the redactions, omissions, and discrepancies mean he's still just living in limbo 6 years after Adam was fatally shot. The document he wanted the most was his son's autopsy, but it was not included in the batch of files turned over in response to Lee Enterprises' public records request. The U.S. Attorney's letter did, however, offer a description of the autopsy's finding. Quote, the trajectory of the bullet traced within Adam's body seems to support the theory that Adam was angled forward or leaning forward or running forward at the time the shot was fired by the officer. The letter continues, THC in alcohol, 0.195%, was found in Adam's blood. After viewing the letter and FBI documents, Boerbaer went to the Rosebud Sioux Tribal Law Enforcement Building this month to demand yet again to see the documents he has sought for 6 years. This time, he said, Stephen DeNoyer Jr., chief administrator of the Rosebud Sioux Law Enforcement Services Department, and another tribal officer allowed him to view tribal police reports as well as the autopsy. But Boerbaer said he was not allowed to have copies of those documents. DeNoyer did not respond to requests for comment, and Captain Ivor Crow Eagle declined to comment when reached by phone. While viewing the autopsy gave Boerbaer some details, more details about the physical cause of his son's death. It left him wondering if his son was angled forward, not because he was running at the officer, but because he was complying with the order to get down. The U.S. Attorney's Office found that the officer who shot Adam, quote, acted in self-defense and should not be subject to criminal charges, but Boerbaer believes tribal police unnecessarily turned a minor family disagreement into a deadly encounter. Quote, you should be able to resolve a small issue like that without no one getting killed. I'm not against the police. I just want better relations and better communications and better training, he said. And then there are a couple of graphics that go along with this story. There's 1, 2, 3 bar graphs. First one just vertical bars, and it shows in the annual report to Congress, the BIA has consistently found a significant gap between the funding available and money needed to pay for public safety and justice in Indian country. This most recent report was published in February, and it pertains to 2021. And found that these programs were funded at just over 13% of the total that they needed. And the first graph is law enforcement, and it shows, all three graphs show a tiny bit of money that they actually get compared to what they need. And then another graphic is a timeline graphic, and it shows a rate of deadly encounters per 100,000 population. There are 1, 2, 3, 4 lines. White is 0.3. Hispanic, Latino is 0.4. Black, 0.6. And the Native American is way above the other three lines at 1.6. Our next story on the front page, and this is really the only other local story in today's journal. Auditor must give evidence to withhold emails. Case concerned emails between SANS office and journalists. This is from Aaron Murphy. Iowa auditor Rob SANS office must do more to convince the courts that his office's decision to withhold from public release emails between his office and two journalists is legally justified, the Iowa Supreme Court said on Friday. The case involves a 2021 public records request from the Kirkwood Institute, which is an Iowa-based conservative legal organization, for emails between SANS office and two Iowa journalists, the Associated Press's Ryan J. Foley and Laura Bellin of the liberal political news site Bleeding Heartland. SANS office produced some records but withheld 10 emails, saying they were covered by exemptions to the state's public records law that cover whistleblowers and materials that are part of an audit or examination. The Kirkwood Institute challenged that explanation in the courts, and a district judge ruled in SANS' favor. Kirkwood appealed, and the Iowa Supreme Court on Friday rejected the argument from SANS' office that 9 of the 10 emails are exempt from public records law because they were part of an audit. The Supreme Court ruled that the case returned to district court, where SANS' office must provide more evidence for why his office should not release those 9 emails. The Supreme Court also ruled SANS' office properly applied whistleblower protections to the 10th email, which was between his office and a member of the public. All 7 justices joined in both rulings. The opinion was written by Justice Matthew McDermott. Quote, "We are not persuaded that each of these 9 emails, as a matter of law, is covered by the exemption for materials that are part of an audit. For example, some are in the form of a request for information from the reporter to the auditor's office," McDermott wrote. The opinion continues, "On remand back to the district court, the auditor's office should present evidence for each email to establish that the specific email was actually received in the course of an audit or examination, such as the specific audit or examination to which it relates, a copy of any audit report, and the start and end dates of that audit or examination," McDermott wrote. Kirkwood's public records request came after SANS' office in June 2021 issued a special report on Governor Kim Reynolds' public awareness campaign to stop the spread of COVID-19. SANS' report asserted that Reynolds, by using federal pandemic relief funds to pay for the public service campaign, violated a state law that prohibits office holders from using taxpayer funds for self-promotion. As part of its public records request, Kirkwood sought all emails between the auditor's office and Foley and Bellin. SANS' office produced 2 tranches of records, but withheld 9 emails, citing those materials under audit exemption, and the 10th email citing a whistleblower exemption that protects the publication of communications from the public that would discourage future similar communications. Alan Ostergren, the president and chief counsel for the Kirkwood Institute, who argued the case to the Iowa Supreme Court, praised the court's decision in a statement on Friday and criticized SAND for withholding the emails. Quote, "Rob SAND has said that officials who don't comply with the open records laws should be held accountable," Ostergren said. "I agree. He should be held accountable, and the Supreme Court's decision paves the way for that." The court made clear that he cannot hide all emails with bloggers behind his audit powers. "We look forward to the opportunity to go back to district court to hear SANS' justification for hiding those emails for so long." A spokesperson for SANS' office responded to the request for comment with an emailed statement that reads, "We are disappointed in the need for additional proceedings, but will continue to follow the law and protect whistleblowers and tipsters as always, the auditor's official office, rather, spokesperson said. And turning to page 4, historic preservation, Art Deco architectural heritage to be celebrated in Sioux City. When most people see the rose garden behind the Grandview Park bandshell, well, they see a bunch of roses. But when Tom Munson sees Grandview Park's rose garden, the Sioux City Public Museum archives manager connects it to the history of the community. The rose garden and the bandshell were both Civilian Works Administration, CWA, and later WPA, which is Work Progress Administration projects, that were designated to put people to work during the Great Depression in the 1930s, he said. Each represented the Art Deco style of architecture that was popular at the time. Known for its bold use of geometric shapes, exotic zigzags, and Middle Eastern-inspired motifs, Art Deco brought a sense of drama to a nation reeling from the stock market crash of 1929. Using sleek lines that were influenced by airplanes and ocean liner design, it brought energy, modernity, and most importantly, optimism, during a time when it was desperately needed. As a way to celebrate this form of architecture, the Sioux City Historic Preservation Commission will dedicate May 6th through 11th as, quote, Elegance in Lines, Celebrating Art Deco, with a week's worth of fun and informative events, rather. The week will start with Mayor Bob Scott and the City Council officially announcing the kickoff of Sioux City Historic Preservation Week during its May 6th meeting. At 6 p.m., May 6th, Munson will give a walking tour of the Heights neighborhood that surrounds Grandview Park. While Art Deco was most common in the architecture of buildings and commercial structures, it was a style that was rarely used in the construction of private homes, he said, noting that most of the houses in the Heights featured a prairie school style of architecture. While there are two houses that can be considered Art Deco in design, the majority of homes in the Heights are definitely prairie inspired. Very common in the Midwest to the last 19th and early 20th century, prairie school style homes can be identified through its use of horizontal lines, hipped roofs with overhanging eaves, as well as horizontal lines that were designed to evoke the native prairie landscape. While earlier and later styles of design borrowed from classic European architect, the prairie style was organic to America, Munson said. That wasn't the case with the Badge Row building, which will be awarded the Sioux City Historic Preservation Commission's annual Treasure of Sioux City Award, with a ceremony slated to take place 4 p.m. May 10th on the 622 4th Street building's 12th floor, designed by the Sioux City architectural firm of K.E. Westerlund. The Badge Row was completed in 1933. More than 90 years after it was constructed, the building is now home to the Badge Row Flats, which are apartments that combine the Art Deco of the 20th century with modern conveniences of the 21st century. Indeed, the Badge Row still retains the elements of Art Deco, with its use of vertical piers, bronze ornamentation, and windows which are highlighted with geometric designs. Don't be surprised if the Badge Row building is an answer to a question posed during the Pints of Preservation trivia competition, which is hosted by Munson, that is being held at 6 p.m. May 8th at Buffalo Alice. Sioux City Historic Preservation Week will end with the second annual Sioux City Historic Bike Tour. That will pass by local historic sites, starting at Chautauqua Park at 10 a.m. May 11th, and finish at the Riverside Park. In addition, the Sioux City Railroad Museum, located at 3400 Sioux River Road, will be open from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., giving people a chance to see its historical exhibits with free admission. The highlight of the week for Munson will be the tour of the Heights, which is a neighborhood that he grew up in. You can tell a lot about a community through its houses, he said, The Heights definitely shows the progression of Sioux City over time. And we have no obituaries, no opinions in today's Sioux City Journal, no local sports at all. So there's a page on the E-Edition Plus. This entitled, Americans Are Tired and It's Getting Worse. Here's Why It's So Hard to Get Enough Shut-Eye. From the Associated Press. If you're feeling sleepy or tired while you read this and wish you could get some more shut-eye, you're not alone. A majority of Americans say they would feel better if they could get more sleep, according to a new poll. But in the U.S., the ethos of grinding and pulling yourself up by your bootstraps is ubiquitous, both in the country's beginnings and our current environment of always-on technology and work hours, and getting enough sleep can feel like a dream. The Gallup poll, released earlier this month, found that 57% of Americans say they would feel better if they could get more sleep, while only 42% say they're getting as much sleep as they need. That's a first in Gallup polling since 2001. In 2013, when Americans were last asked, it was just about the reverse. 56% then said that they got the needed sleep, 43% said they didn't. Younger women under the age of 50 were especially likely to report that they weren't getting enough rest. The poll also asked respondents to report how many hours of sleep they usually get per night. Only 26% said that they got 8 or more hours, which is about the amount of sleep that experts say is recommended for health and mental well-being. Just over half, 53%, reported getting 6 to 7 hours, and 20% said they got 5 hours or less. That's a jump from the 14% who reported getting the least amount of sleep in 2013. And just to make you feel even more tired, in 1942, the vast majority of Americans were sleeping more. Some 59% said they slept 8 or more hours. The poll does not get into the reasons Americans aren't getting the sleep they need, and since Gallup last asked the question in 2013, there's no data breaking down the particular impact of the past 4 years and the pandemic era. But what is notable, says Sarah Fioroni, a senior researcher at Gallup, is the shift in the past decade toward more Americans thinking that they would benefit from more sleep, and particularly the jump in the number of those saying they would get 5 or less hours. That 5 or less category was almost not really heard of in 1942, Fioroni said. There's almost nobody that said they slept 5 hours or less. In modern American life, there also has been this pervasive belief about how sleep was unnecessary, that it was this period of inactivity where little to nothing was actually happening, and that took up time that could have been better used, said Joseph Dzierzewski, Vice President for Research and Scientific Affairs at the National Sleep Foundation. It's only relatively recently that the importance of sleep to physical, mental, and emotional health has started to percolate more in the general population, he said. And there's still a long way to go. For some Americans, just like Justine Brugal, age 31, who's a self-employed event planner with 2 small children, there simply are not enough hours in the day. So even though she recognizes the importance of sleep, it often comes in below other priorities like her 4-month-old son, who still wakes up during the night, or her 3-year-old daughter. I really treasure being able to spend time with my children, she said. Part of the benefit of being self-employed is that I get a more flexible schedule, but it's definitely often at the expense of my own care. So why are we awake all the time? One likely reason for Americans' sleeplessness is cultural, a long-standing emphasis on industriousness and productivity. Some of the context is much older than the shifted document in the poll. It includes the Protestants from European countries who colonized the country, said Claude Fisher, who is a professor of sociology at the Graduate School of the University of California, Berkeley. Their belief system included the idea that working hard and being rewarded with success was evidence of divine favor. It's been a core part of American culture for centuries, he said. You could make the argument that it, in the secularized form over the centuries, becomes just a general principle that the morally correct person is somebody who doesn't waste their time. Jennifer Sherman has seen that in action. In her research in rural American communities over the years, the sociology professor at Washington State University says a common theme among people she interviewed was the importance of having a solid work ethic. That applied not only to paid labor, but unpaid labor as well, like making sure that the house was clean. A through line of American cultural mythology is the idea of being, quote, individually responsible for creating our own destiny, she said. And that does suggest that if you're wasting too much of your time, that you are responsible for your own failure. The other side of the coin is a massive amount of disdain for people considered lazy, she said. While the poll only shows a broad shift over the past decade, living through the COVID-19 pandemic may have affected people's sleep patterns. Also discussed in post-COVID life is, quote, revenge bedtime procrastination. That's when people put off sleeping and instead scroll on social media or binge a show as a way of trying to handle stress. Liz Michelle is familiar with that. The 30-year-old American is temporarily living in Bulgaria on a research grant, but also works part-time on U.S. hours to make ends meet. On the nights when her work schedule stretches to 10 p.m., she finds herself in a revenge procrastination cycle. She wants some time to herself to decompress before going to sleep, and she ends up sacrificing sleeping hours to make it happen. That applies to bedtime as well, where I'm like, well, I didn't have any me time during the day, and it's now 10 p.m., so I'm going to feel totally fine and justified watching X number of episodes of TV, spending this much time on Instagram as my way to decompress, she said, which obviously will always make the problem worse. And then it shows just photos of people sleeping. Graduating senior Chad Burnett takes a nap June 17th before his commencement ceremony. But in the U.S., getting enough shut-eye can seem like a dream. And also from the E-Edition Plus today, technology reviews. Nice devices. The best 5G phone options available now. In 2024, there isn't one specific phone that stands head and shoulders above the others. If you're an iOS user, the best phone you can buy is the iPhone 15 Pro. It has an A17 Pro processor, a new main camera with a larger and higher megapixel sensor, a new action button, and the Dynamic Island, which is a display cutout that shows system alerts and background activities. If you're on Android, your best bet is the $800 Samsung Galaxy S24. The battery life is amazing, but that's not the only reason it's the best Android phone. It gets 7 years of major Android updates. The cameras are good. There's even a 3x telephoto lens for zooming. And then there are all the AI features. Samsung didn't reinvent the phone, but it did take a great phone, the Galaxy S23, and make it better. Nearly every phone from Apple, Samsung, and Google is 5G ready. That means these smartphones come equipped to deliver the fastest possible data speeds across your wireless network. And while they tend to be pricey, there are plenty of affordable 5G options like the Google Pixel 6a and Apple's cheapest, the 2022 iPhone SE. Here are three of the best 5G phones out there. Number one, the Samsung Galaxy S24. What's most impressive about the Samsung Galaxy S24 isn't the new Galaxy AI features, brighter screens, or solid cameras. It's the battery life. The larger battery in the S24 has no trouble plowing through a long day of use on a single charge. It's a wonderful, well-built phone that is excellent right out of the box, just as the nearly identical S-22 and S-23 were before it. The similarity to the S-22 and the S-23 can be viewed as either a strength because the design reflects 3 years of refinements, or a weakness because features like the camera hardware are essentially identical to what came out in 2022. But all of this is overshadowed by the great battery life. You'll never hear anyone complain about it getting too much battery life. And it doesn't say a price or anything here. Next one is the Samsung Galaxy Z Flip 5, which is the best 5G foldable phone. The Galaxy Z Flip 5 is the biggest leap forward Samsung's flip phone has seen in years. Samsung has significantly expanded the size of the cover screen located on the outside of the device, meaning you can look up directions, take photos, and send messages without opening the phone. It's this combined with the Z Flip's solid battery life and sturdy design that make it a top pick. The Z Flip 5 may be the top flip phone, but there are still some drawbacks to be aware of. At $1,000, it's still expensive for a phone without a telephoto camera. And not all apps work natively on the front screen, as they do on the Motorola Razr Plus. And the best overall phone, the Apple iPhone 15 Pro. Apple's iPhone 15 Pro brings a variety of changes, including a new customizable action button, powerful camera upgrades, thinner bezels, a lightweight titanium design, and the new A17 Pro processor. All these upgrades come together to make for an experience that feels fresh and fast and compared to the older versions. Starting at $999, it is the most expensive iPhone you can buy, especially if you opt for the larger Max version, which goes for $1,199. But if you want the high performance and stellar camera quality of Apple's top phone, then the iPhone 15 Pro is for you. And taking a look at Siouxland weather, mostly cloudy today, Monday, showers in southeastern South Dakota during the morning, windy in western Iowa and southwestern Minnesota, sunny to partly cloudy, pleasant and milder in northeastern Nebraska. Mainly clear tonight, except for mostly cloudy in southeastern South Dakota. And today, it looks like a high of 62, mostly cloudy. Tonight, low of 41, mainly clear. Tuesday, a strong afternoon thunderstorm is predicted with a high of 77 and low of 46. Wednesday, showers around but not as warm, with a high of 67, low of 53. Thursday, a couple of showers, high of 61, low of 44. And Friday, breezy with clouds and sun, with a high of 65, low of 42. And our national forecast, severe weather will continue today, this time, focusing on areas near the central Gulf Coast and inland to southwestern Tennessee. A cold storm will bring showers across the northwest with enough chill to produce some accumulating snow at the highest peaks of Oregon and Idaho. Rain and thunder will spread across the Great Lakes regions. And the hot spot in the world today looks to be, oh, it's kind of cool out there, 91 in Washington, D.C., 91 in San Antonio. And as far as being cool goes, Anchorage, 49 today. And I think that's our coolest spot. And you are super cool for listening to Iris in the Sioux City Journal for Monday, April 29, 2024. I'm your reader, Mary Frances, and this has been the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. All material heard on Iris is intended solely for the use of our friends with print disabilities. You can catch this and so many of our other programs right there on our website, which is iowaradioreading.org. It's been a pleasure to read for you today. Have a great day.